God isn't seeing what you're seeing because you're seeing human thought. Now, whoever can't get this is going to have a difficulty riding into Jerusalem. And whoever hears it and doesn't dwell with it is going to have difficulty too. As a matter of fact, it's awfully difficult to accept. And yet, it's the ultimate truth that we have to face. We have to pull away the veil, the lie, which comes disguised as separate forms, separate objects, separate conditions, separate things, if we are ever to see and understand and live in the one undivided self. Your world, my world, his world, her world, is the dream of a world mind. And we have been accomplices to our own suicide, to our own pains, to our own grievances. And oh, it's easy after you begin to accept it to find that you were told this in practically every word of the Bible. Everywhere you turn, it's telling you you're living in a dream world. Look, there's Adam sleeping, dreaming about Eve coming out of his rib. Do you believe that? It's a dream, isn't it? There's all the children of Eve cursed by the Father. Why, it must be a dream. Look at all the killing. It must be a dream. One son kills another son. Do you think it's happening, or is it a dream? And there's a flood, and everything on the earth is buried, except two of a kind. You believe it? It's all a dream. You're being told again and again and again, get out of the dream. And the secret of the dream is world thought. Individually interpreted as human thought. You're in a room right now, but you're not in a room. Who says you're in a room? Your mind says you're in a room, and your mind doesn't know where you are, because your mind is a dream mind, and all it can know is a dream world, a dream room. And so you look at the walls and you say, there it is, there's the wall. We can burn those walls with a match. We can crush those walls with a hammer. We can't do that to God's creation. In the dream, we can do every kind of deviltry imaginable. In the dream, we can kill people. That's because it's in the dream. And that's why in the dream we die. When the thought runs out, the death occurs. The end of thought is the end of the dream for that individual. Now, science helps us. Science is invisibly one of the great arms that is giving us an answer for that which we couldn't understand, even though science doesn't know they're giving us the answer. And so you look at the wall, you say, there's the wall, but it isn't there. Science says, that's atoms. That's great. That's true. That's atoms. What science can tell us is that atoms are part of the dream too. There isn't an atom in this universe that isn't part of the dream fabric of thought. The only difference is that the atoms are the thought of the world mind before your human mind gets to those atoms. The human mind only is looking at atoms. And what are you looking with? You're looking with atoms of your own eyes. Now let's get the whole picture here. There is an invisible spiritual universe right now, right here. And it's perfect. And it doesn't need correction, and that's all that's here. And in it, you're living in your reality. In it, Christ lives. In it, the Christ you is living now, enjoying the fruits of the Spirit. Being self. Being eternal. Being the child of God. That is the allness. And that Christ did not incarnate as you. That Christ is all you are, and you are that Christ now behind the veil of world thought. Christ never incarnates. There is no incarnation. Christ is spirit. You are that being. I am that being. Everyone we know is that invisible being called Christ. And we all have infinite individuality in Christ. Christ John, Christ Jesus, Christ Peter, Christ you. You are there now. And then the world mind looks at this invisible spiritual creation and forms its concept called atoms. That's the first world thought, atoms, separating the indivisible into little particles of electricity, separate little particles. That's what you're looking at when you see a wall. And you're looking at it with the atoms of your eyes, and what makes the wall is the reaction of your eyes with its atoms to the atoms of the wall. You're looking at something you cannot see, and the atoms of your eyes reacting to the atoms that are there form and clothe those atoms with a concept called wall. The difference in speed between the atoms where the wall is and the atoms of your eyes creates the wall. You clothe everything you see with a reaction of the atoms of your eyes to the atoms that you are looking at. You're looking at the dream thought of the world mind, and that dream thought is atoms, and you're looking out of human eyes, which are made of atoms, and the reaction is wall, person, thing, place, tree. And then you say, well, why do I see a bird? Why does everybody see a bird? And the answer is simple. You look at the atoms over there and you see a bird, and I look over there and I see a bird. It's because the atoms over there are in a pattern. And if we look somewhere else, we'll both see a giraffe. Why? Because the atoms over there are in a pattern. We're reacting to the patterns of atoms. Over there, the pattern is such that we all see wall. But the atoms aren't there. God didn't put them there. The world mind did. God didn't put the atoms where your eyes are. The world mind did. The eyes that you look with are part of the dream. The atoms you're looking at are part of the dream. The reaction is part of the dream. He hangeth the earth on nothing. And so you look. Atoms react to atoms. The patterns are set by the world mind, and your reaction is modified only slightly by your heredity and environment, past experience. But basically, we're all looking at the same patterns. And we're fooled into clothing those patterns with bodies of flesh, which are nothing more than our own thought reactions. Now, this is the inner formation of the dream. I'm sure in time there will be some great minds who will reveal much deeper understanding of it and fill it out with all kinds of scientific explanations. But I'm sure you can see that if the atoms of your eyes are going at such a speed and the atoms over there are going at a greater speed, your reaction to them can form an impression, which you call steel, wood, tree, bird. The forms of the world are made that way. We clothe atoms with our minds. Now then, if you can't overcome your thought, you're going to go on continuing to build a dream world, which the world mind builds through you. You'll continue in Adam's dream. And so it becomes so utterly clear why we're told, take no thought for your life. Take no thought. Judge not after the appearances. Resist not evil. Be still and know. All of this is to break the continuity of the dream. and to awaken us out of being a dream character, a creature who receiveth not. I gather this one is going to build that house we were just talking about. Now, the reason we're facing this today is because we're on our way to Jerusalem. And there's no way there as long as we live in the dream. Now, there are ways to start seeing through the dream. First of all, we know that others have come out of the dream, have been enlightened. We know that others have made transition. We know that others have been able to come into a way of life in which they are no longer controlled by world thought and can look through appearances unaffected by them, unaffected by the appearance of two powers, and have been reunited in oneness with that which the world mind is trying to counterfeit. Now, there is no sickness or sadness or sorrow or limitation or lack except in the dream. And when you try to correct these things and seemingly succeed and find that a week later or a month later that which you succeeded in doing seems to fall apart again, it's because you were not aware that the total circumstance and the characters in it are world mind dream creations, yourself included. Now, we haven't faced this, have we? We haven't been willing to. Nobody wants to tell us to face it either. It's much more pleasant to go on ignoring it, pretending that if we just do certain nice things, things will work out fine. And that's what the world's been doing. I don't know anyone you're going to tell this to, because if you do, you'll discover you really have no one to listen to you. The only time you can tell this is when you have proved to yourself that it's true. And if you haven't, you have no right to say it to another. You've got to prove it to yourself. And if it's not true, fine, that's great. Even in proving it's not true, you've done something. But you might discover that it not only is true, but it's the only truth. And that until you meet this truth and come past this truth, all that you try to do in the way of learning truth is barricaded. That you'll continue living a dream lifespan with dream people, with dream conditions, with dream financing, and it won't work. The fabric of the dream is your thought. It isn't your thought. It's what thought is forced upon you to become your thought. And you've got to break it. And that's where we'll take our break. Rest for about a few minutes in a meditation. before we try to find ways to come out of world thought. The question before me here is, where does world thought come from? And I know that the answer will not be accepted, because world thought doesn't exist. It's the dream too. And then the question is, well, how does a dream begin? How does it get here? Why is it here? And the only answer you can get is going to be directed to a dream mind. Because only the dream mind wants to know why, how, and when. It's part of the dream. And the best way to answer the question is to go back into a character in your dream who wants to know. And you'll see that anything he wants to know, he doesn't really want to know, because he isn't there. He seems to be there, and he seems to want to know, and the point that you're not getting is that you're the dream. And therefore anything you want to know is part of the dream. And it's only when you awaken from the dream that you'll see that the mind that asks the question is part of the dream. I don't expect you to accept it, but at least the important thing to see is that we remain characters in the dream, and everything we do in the dream is part of the dream, even the desire to know. The only mind there is God. The only thought there is God, out of that divine mind. Now, while we want to know where does world thought come from, suppose you were in the flood. And your home was floating down the tide. Would you be more interested in knowing where it came from, or would you be more interested in knowing how to be safe, how to survive? Would you at that moment want to know the why and wherefore, or would you be more interested in self-preservation? Are you more interested in the truth, or are you more interested in knowing the why and the wherefore? The human mind is the natural mind. It receiveth not the things of God. The truth can only come to you from Christ. In fact, Isaiah's statement of the Christ, "My thoughts are not your thoughts," is the revelation that only Christ in you can dissolve the dream and the dream mind. And only the Christ mind in you knoweth the Father. Now, we would have to be the very infinite spirit totally in order to be able to explain why these things happen as appearances in the world mind. But we do know that the Father says, "Be ye perfect." Now, who is saying to the Father, "Explain it to me why these things are happening"? Who is saying that? The one who is not saying that because the Father says it, it is so. There is no reason that the human mind will accept, but there is a spiritual something which says it is so. And if you're going to live within the realm of reason and want to know how it got there, you're going to miss the point of the dream. Because the realm of reason is part of the dream. The illusion on the desert is there. That's a fact. The world is not your father's kingdom. That's a fact. Now, if you want to know how the world got there, even though it's not your father's kingdom, you'll have to come into Christ. Because nobody in this world is going to tell you how the world got there and how there could be a world mind when the world mind itself has no existence. There is no world mind. That's why the complete illusion of the dream person, the mortal being, the mortal life, the mortal lifespan, becomes a dream. It comes out of a dream mind. And you come to the vanishing point where you're left with a world mind that isn't there, but which is dreaming a dream world. And the only way you can solve that riddle is to live in the truth of that which is present. You can't solve it in a conversation or a discussion or a mind speaking to a mind. Two dream minds talking to each other will not get anywhere. You must join that Christ spirit in yourself which dissolves the world mind. And when you have the experience, you won't need the conversation or the human explanation of it. The experience is the only answer to your question. Until then, you'll have to simply know that there is no world mind to have the dream of this world, and that the complete dream of this world is in a world mind which is a dream itself. And that is precisely why it's been so difficult for mankind to step out of the dream, because it isn't aware of the condition or what's causing the condition. It only knows that somewhere in the Bible the Father said, "Be ye perfect," and it's trying so hard to be and doesn't know how to be. The homes are floating down the river, and here's the voice saying, "Be ye perfect." How? How can any one of those who have been made desolate be perfect while the homes are floating down the river? But look at it another way. When the voice says, "Be ye perfect," does it mean just on Tuesday or Wednesday, or does it mean every instant, "Be ye perfect"? Now then, if the homes are floating down the river, how can I be perfect? The answer is that I've got to see the truth that there's no home floating down the river. That's the only way I can be perfect. As long as there's a home floating down the river, you can't say you're perfect. The dream of a world that is in torment must be seen as non-existent. There is no world in torment. There is no world at war. There is no world in grief. There is no world in disease. I don't need a reason for that. It's the Father's word. My kingdom is not this world. There's no reason. It's simply the truth. And that's why I say you must find absolute truth. If you find truth that's reason, it isn't truth. The only truth that's truth is the truth spoken by the Father. That's the point. And the Father says, "This world is not my kingdom." That is all you need to know. It's a dream world. And until you're willing to accept the Father's word without further question, you'll always say, "I don't understand this." We don't have to understand the Father, you see? Those who want to understand are going to be on the outside looking in, wondering why they couldn't attain the level of Christ consciousness. The disciples couldn't understand either. It said so. But they were obedient to the Christ which says, do this, do that. Now, if you don't believe the truth of these words in the Bible, that's another thing. But if you do, don't let your lack of understanding of them stop you. You'll see that in a minute. Here some Greeks appear. It doesn't seem to be of major importance that suddenly a few Greeks appear at a meeting here. But they go to Philip. Philip takes them to Andrew. Together, Philip and Andrew go to Jesus. And as soon as he learned the Greeks have come, he says the most amazing thing. All through the Bible, he's saying, my hour has not yet come. Mine hour has not yet come. He repeats it and repeats it. But now a few Greeks show up at a meeting and he says, my hour has come. Why don't they go direct to Jesus? Why do they go to Philip and then to Andrew? That's the answer to your question right there. First Philip, and then Philip goes to Andrew, and then Philip and Andrew go to Jesus. Do you see the chain of command? That Philip represents something in us, Andrew something in us, and both Philip and Andrew have to go to the Christ. And that the only way the Greeks can come to the Christ is through Philip in us and Andrew in us. Philip is the mind that says, I don't understand. Philip is the human mind. But it understands enough to know to go to Andrew. And Andrew does understand, and Andrew has the strength, the will, to be obedient to what he understands. The outer intellect says, all right, I heard it. But Andrew says, I not only heard it, I will do it. This is Philip and Andrew, and together they go to I am the Christ. It's the faith to live and to abide not in your understanding. You must transcend human understanding. As long as you want to understand, which is commendable, you're going to limit yourself to what you understand. There is a place where you do not understand, and yet you go forth. And that's the point of lean not on thine own understanding. There's a place where Philip and Andrew together move to Christ, still not knowing what they're doing. But they are obedient, and the word faith, to accept the word of the Christ beyond your own understanding. Do you see that? If you're going to say, I don't understand how the world mind gets there, and stand there and wait for that understanding, you're not going to do what Philip and Andrew do right here. Now, the importance of the Greeks will also clarify something. It's really a long, long story. The Greeks are in contrast to the Jews. Later, Paul will say, there's neither Greek nor Jew. The Jews have been set up as those who, in us, are the qualities of mind that reject divine selfhood. The Jew in us says, I'm a human being, and I worship God. And there's only one God, and I worship him. And this is the rejection of the truth that God is the substance of every individual on the earth, that God is the substance of the Jew. God is the substance of the Gentile. God is the substance of the Muslim, the Hindu, etc. But the Jew in us refuses to accept that the Spirit of God is our being. And so the Jew is in the dream. The Jew lives in the dream of the world mind, thinking it's worshiping God. Now comes the Greek. And the Greek wants Christ. The Jew has rejected Christ. The Greek wants Christ. There's another phase in us. While the Jew in us is rejecting, the Greek in us is willing to be converted. Wants Christ. and is coming and seeks Christ and says to Philip, we would have an audience with Jesus. And Philip, the outer mind, turns to Andrew, the strength, the obedience to faith, and says they want to see Jesus. And then the outer mind and the obedience that acts in faith to the outer mind goes in together to the Christ and says, the Greeks are here, and the Christ says, mine hour is come. Why? Goes right back to Lazarus. The resurrected consciousness opened that day on earth is also manifesting as the unconverted, the unchristed, the Greeks, coming to find the Christ, showing the universality of Christ. And it goes way, way back. I think it might be well to take a minute to see it way, way back. It goes back to Egypt. It was from Egypt that the Greeks, you see, found the mysteries. And there was Orpheus. And out of Orpheus came what is called the Greek Orphic Mysteries. It seems that long before Jesus Christ walked the earth, the truth that he presented was known. In fact, Orpheus was called the Greek Christ. And that was 12 centuries before Jesus Christ. They actually were teaching in Greece at that time that there is one spirit, one God, one soul, and that God is infinite and one in number and is the unseen spirit behind all that we call nature. Orpheus taught that. In fact, Orpheus did many miracles. Orpheus, it was said, played a harp given to him by the gods. And you can see the meaning when you learn that that harp that he played was so celestial in its tone that great monsters came out of the sea just to listen to it. And that he could tame the storm, tame the tides, he could tame all manner of natural phenomenon. But even savage beasts would listen to this tone and they would lose all ferocity. This was the story of Orpheus. And this became part of the mystical teachings in the mystery schools of Greece. Actually, 1,200 years before Jesus, they taught that God did not create corporeal beings. That atoms were the substance of all matter, the substance of all that was good and evil, and was not divinely created. They taught that if you did not attain your eternal soul, you would come back into this atomic illusion of corporeality. And then he had a seven-string lyre that he played beside. And always it was called music of the gods, celestial music. There were many composers who discovered the power of Orpheus. Richard Wagner was one, and later Igor Stravinsky. But there was in Greece a man named Pythagoras. And around 550, he made the teaching of Orpheus the part of his movement. And this is what fathered the understanding of Orphic mysteries right down to Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. But by now, you see, the pure mysticism of Asia was tempered by science and philosophy. And so they took ecstasy as seen in the Asian and they gave it a sense of order. They took faith and they backed it up with knowledge. Things were given a form and a substance that up to then had simply been in the mystical world. But then it was lost. It became too much form, too much science, too much philosophy. And so the Orphic mysteries became a forgotten mystery. It was picked up, however, by the Essenes, by Enoch among the Essenes, not the real Enoch, but the teacher among the Essenes who called himself Enoch. And so the Greeks had lost it. In other words, that part of the world which it had the mystical truth of the one divine spirit as the substance of all being, lost it. I, Spirit of God in Christ Jesus, was the very spirit of truth of Orpheus, of Pythagoras, of Socrates, of Plato, of Aristotle. Is there another spirit than I, Christ? And even though this is lost through the centuries and now pops up in the divine form called Christ Jesus, the moment the Greek appears, you see, this is a tying together of all the threads of spiritual unfoldment on the earth. Because now that which was out of the mystical truth, that seed which had been planted years before, centuries before, now is fertile. And the Greek is turning to the Christ, and East and West are meeting again. And so I, the Christ in Jesus, recognizes I, the Christ in the Greek, and this is a sign that the world is being tied into one. Now my hour has come. Much more that could be said, but there are words to be used that we're not ready for. One of them is androgynous, and you can look it up. Find out what it means, and you'll have a clue to the meaning of the Greek appearing. Further, you'll find that androgynous means neither male nor female. And Paul caught that. The union in oneself, in which one becomes pure spirit, is neither male nor female. And this was the mystical marriage signified to Jesus Christ by the Greek. The Greek chain of the Orphic mysteries coming into visibility. For the story of Orpheus was the mystical marriage. Now, there's so much you could say about this sort of thing, but you'd really have to go back and back and study all of the things that were taught in the Greek mystery schools. And the reason it's always remained a mystery is because the basic teaching of the mystery schools, always shrouded in words, is that all corporeal existence is a universal dream. There are passages here which I think you should see about the Greek stranger. Let's first see this. There were certain Greeks among them that came up to worship at the feast. The same, therefore, came to Philip, which was of Bethsaida of Galilee, and desired him, saying, Sir, we would see Jesus. Philip cometh and telleth Andrew. And again, Andrew and Philip tell Jesus. They came together. Understanding came with faith and the will to obey that. That's why they came together. Jesus answered them, saying, The hour is come that the Son of Man should be glorified. There is precedence for this in various passages in the Bible. You remember, first of all, in Paul, in the Acts, that he worked among the Greeks. And there the Jews burned Jason's house, symbol of rejecting the Greeks as being important enough for the truth. And yet Paul stayed with the Greeks and did a great work among the Greeks, wrote to the Corinthians and so on. Now, earlier in the Bible, in Isaiah, we have a little hint about the Greeks. And that's 42:4. Some of this doesn't add up to reason, but it shows you the thread of prophecy. How the infinite mind, which is working there, works over here 2,000 years later, and it's really working in both areas at the same time. In Isaiah 42:4, he shall not fail nor be discouraged till he have set judgment in the earth, and the isles shall wait for his law. The isles, you see, means the Grecian isles. It doesn't say so. It was on the Isle of Patmos that John was given the great revelation about New Jerusalem. The isles shall wait for his word. The Grecian isles had lost the real deep truth, but they would return to Christ. Isaiah, the Christ speaking through, says the isles shall wait for his law. Here the Christ in Jesus, here's the Greeks have come. You see how it ties up? The one self, announcing what it will do and then doing it. But, more so, we see in Genesis a very strange combination. And this is really delightful if you're a Bible lover. Because in Genesis, we tie up Greeks and jackasses. And the whole thing is right there. Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies, thy father's children. Judah's a lion, a whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come. Now Shiloh is the Christ. And unto him shall the gathering of the people be. Binding his foal unto the vine, and his ass's colt unto the choice vine, he washed his garments in wine, and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes shall be red with wine, and his teeth white with milk. Now here you see that the Christ will come on an ass's colt, way back in Genesis, and it talks about the red wine, and you remember the Christ changing water to wine. You see how it begins to pull in the thread of prophecy way back in Genesis, up to Zechariah, and then in the actual appearance, but it's always the invisible Christ. That's why it appears that way. It's inevitable. And whatever the invisible Christ ordains in you is inevitable. There's no power on earth to stop it. Now, again, a stranger thing, perhaps in Kings, and this is why, again, Jesus Christ was so sure his hour had come. Because the Christ had so predicted. 1 Kings 8:41. Moreover, concerning a stranger that is not of thy people Israel, but cometh out of a far country for my name's sake. You see the vast movement of mysticism out of Greece, being lost and then coming into fruition in this visible little group of Greeks coming as predicted way back in Kings, and an ass's colt way back in Genesis and again in Zechariah, all this being woven together in one appearance. Do you feel the deep thread of truth of the Word, how it's inevitably the only thing you can follow? What else can know? What else can be reality? Do you see why that vein in you must touch this I Christ truth? Mine hour has come. And now the Greek represents the conversion of the world to Christ. This then will be the beginning of the universal nature of Christ accepted on the earth as an actual fact to be realized, and it appears, within our generation. Do you know why there was to be an end of the world? And what it meant now? Why would the heavens roll up like a scroll? When you awake from the dream, isn't that the effect? Isn't that exactly what happens when you awake from a dream? What is the end of the world? The end of a dream. Be perfect, because God didn't create these evils. They're in the dream. Where else can they be if God didn't create them? They must be in the dream. Cancer is part of a dream. Pain is part of a dream. Every limitation, every imperfection is part of a dream. It rolls up like a scroll when you awaken from the dream. And now there's a Greek here awakening from a dream. He's reaching for Christ. The something in us that reaches for Christ is ready to awaken from the dream. Let's go a step further. Where the dream is, God is. The dream isn't there. God is. That's why it's called a dream. Because it isn't there. But if God is there, isn't perfection there? What are you going to correct? Can you correct perfection? Now then, when you know it's a dream, when you know perfection is present where the dream seems to be, and you change your consciousness to the realization of that perfection in spite of what the dream appears to present, isn't that the healing consciousness? Do you see that you can't really have what God didn't create? It has to be a dream. And if God didn't create a bad vision or a bad back or a bad heart, how can you have one? And if your heart is capable of being imperfect, how could God create it? Anything that can be imperfect cannot be God's creation. What is it? It's a dream. And so you're being told that you don't have a heart. You're dreaming about a heart. You don't have lungs. You're dreaming about lungs. You don't have a physical form. You're dreaming about a physical form. And when you awaken from the dream, you come into that consciousness gradually, which enables you to feel that which is not the human heart, but which is your spiritual self. And gradually you're awakened out of the false sense called incarnation. Until there is a newborn consciousness, a cult. You're out of the false sense of self. Man, said Job, is born an ass. That's a specific quote. Man is born an ass. But the Christ says, that's fine, but he can be reborn a colt with a new consciousness. Christ sitting in the saddle, riding into the higher consciousness, the mortal dream is broken. And now this turning, as you are walking, riding on the new truth, that you're not the dream. The dream is imperfection, it's good and evil. That's the tree of knowledge of good and evil, the dream. But right where the dream seems to be, ye be perfect, which is the same thing as be ye perfect. And so you're riding on the truth, right where the dream seems to be, and you're going with the faith of Andrew and the strength of Andrew, coupled with the knowledge that Philip has brought to Andrew, and the Greek, that deep desire to be converted, to return to the Father's house, is reaching for the Christ. It's all being welded into the one universal self, out of the dream. But to make sure you know it, listen. Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a germ of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. Now, the Orphic Mysteries taught about a germ of wheat, and it taught about man being that germ of wheat. The Mysteries of Greece. Now, you know the husk has to fall off for the fruit to grow. This human body, this dream image, is the husk. The human lifespan is the husk. The world is the husk. The world dream is the husk. And when you conquer it, you overcome the world dream. You're awakening from the dream. But what's awakening? That which is awakening is not in the dream. And right where you seem to be, there's something in you awakening. That's the slumbering Christ, to which the dream is asleep. It's only when you're willing to shuck off the husk, the world dream, that something in you comes alive to your consciousness. That's the meaning of it. Unless, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth not. It abideth alone. But if it die, if you let the dream be accepted, you see, you can only die to the dream. You can't die to reality. If it die, if the dream dies, it bringeth forth much fruit. Then out of the dream rises the reality of your being. That's why it's important to recognize the dream. And the best way to recognize it is to go inside and just rest there and imagine. Or recall a dream. Anything you've dreamed. And you see how quickly that condition within the dream, whatever it was, is a perfect parallel of your human condition, which we do not recognize as the dream, although it is. He that loveth his life shall lose it. Why would they want you to lose it? You see? Because it's a dream. He that loveth his life shall lose it. And he that hateth his life in this world shall keep it unto life eternal. Why would the Christ be saying, he that hateth his life in this world shall keep it? Are you to hate your life if it's the life of God? And if it isn't the life of God, is it not a dream? He that recognizes that his human life is a dream is he who hateth his life in this world. And he shall keep it unto life eternal. The moment you recognize the dream life, you're really recognizing the hereditary life is the dream. The physical life is the dream. The human sense of life is the dream. It's the atomic dream, all based on invisible atoms that we don't see. And as soon as you break the bubble of the atomic dream, you find your life. In a meditation the other day, we were given an interesting start on breaking the dream, which I'd like to share with you. We visioned within ourselves, first, that all being human thought, if I can step out of human thought, the dreamer, the world mind, has no channel through me. to dream. And so in the stillness, the Sabbath, the fast, taking no thought, I am out of the dream. But, you see, you have to establish the habit of looking at everything knowing it's thought. It doesn't matter what you look at. You have to recognize it as thought. It isn't just in your meditation. And so the habit to start is to identify the world around you and everything in it as thought. And here's one way to do it. In the quiet now, we envision this man running. He's racing. He's trying to do a 4-minute mile. And he's in his athletic suit, and he's running up the hill on the track. Fast, fast, fast. You see him in your mind. Now, if you were to see him visibly in the outer world, that would be the same as seeing him now in your mind. In your mind, as you see him run, now bring him into slow motion. So that you have a man who isn't running as fast as he was, but he's moving slowly. Just like a movie would be brought into slow motion. Every step real slow, even as he runs, you are controlling his pace to slow motion. What you've done is to slow down world thought in you. So now the man running fast is running in slow motion. It's still your thought, but it's slower thought. Now from slow motion, slow him down to no motion, so that he's not running at all. It's your thought controlling his movement. He's not running. All of this you're voluntarily controlling within your mind. And him running slower and then not at all is all your thought. And finally, dismiss the man and you have no man. No thought of a man. All in your thought. Now, as you develop this, you should be able to look out as if the man actually were in your view. And if you were to see such a man, you should be able to do the same thing in your mind while looking at him. Until you realize that what you're looking at, whether it's inside your mind with your eyes closed or with your eyes wide open, you're not seeing a man. You're seeing your thought. And your thought says he's running fast, and consciously bring him into slow motion and then into no motion and then into disappearance. Now, as you do this, you will develop the capacity to come into no thought. This graduation or diminution from the running down to the no running, and finally no man, this becomes a habit. So we look at anything that moves, we go through the same no motion, slow motion, no motion, and then finally no object. What is out there actually? If you were dreaming about an airplane, would it be there? If you were dreaming about freeways, would they be there? They'd vanish when you awaken. When you awaken from the mortal dream, there are no freeways, and there are no airplanes. You see, the Christ teaches this is a dream civilization. And everything you're looking at is world thought. And only when you are willing to form the habit of identifying it as world thought, and then knowing that you're looking at thought, don't give it the power that you thought it had. It isn't a man running. It isn't a tiger. It isn't a serpent. It isn't a bomb. It isn't a flood. I know the mind says, oh, well, you just send that flood right through here and it's going to drown us. What do you mean it's not a flood? Don't forget the Christ walking on the water, peace be still at his eye. The mind that says these things, it's not a flood, or it is rather, isn't accepting the truth of Christ. You're putting your mind over the truth of Christ. We're not doing that. We're accepting the truth of Christ, which says, peace be still, it is I. Meaning it isn't you, it's I. And that storm is still, because I, the Christ, and the reality there, and the storm at sea, is world thought. Don't overlook the miracles. They are revealing that world thought appears as the problem, and divine thought appears as the solution. When you're not in this world thought, you slow down the world to slow motion and then no motion and then no world. As you begin to look out that way, you'll begin to feel the non-power of what it appeared to be matter, which was nothing more than your mind clothing the world with a material garment. As your thought is refined out of thought, divine thought will take over, lifting the Son of Man. The ear of corn must die. We must overcome our mortal sense of life, which is human thought. That's the fabric of the world, the fabric of mortal life. Now, I've given you quite a number of things to do, and it's in the doing that you find the capacity to stand before the so-called powers of the world, knowing that they exist only in your thought. There are no external powers because there is no external world. There is only your thought appearing to you as a world. That's pretty big stuff to sit and digest in one meeting. But if you are able to listen to it on your tape, or you'll be hearing more of it again, I'm sure, here, you will begin to see that thought is the nature of the world, and divine thought is the nature of the kingdom. You ride to Jerusalem on divine thought, not on human thought. And heaven replaces earth. This is the mystical message of the infinite way, not the letter of truth. Don't worry if you don't understand it. The disciples weren't picked for their great understanding. They were picked for their obedience and their faith to the word of the Christ. Understanding then came later. Next week is July 4th, and we'll be open. You might try to be somewhat inventive, although we had a runner running 4 mile, the 4-minute mile, slowed down in slow motion. You could take the tides of the ocean and see that they are nothing but thought. Slow them down in your mind. Don't expect the tides out there to slow down, or don't expect the runner to slow down out there. But you get the habit of recognizing this is thought. And instead of thought controlling you, ultimately you'll decide that it's very possible for divine thought to come in and dissolve human thought as you diminish your thought that way. That's how we're going to break the veil of thought.